Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, we spend so much time in the office, late nights, and even weekends. There's never enough time at home with family and friends, right? Well, there is a way to strike a balance. Get your work done and spend more time at home with GoToMyPC. With just a click, you can instantly access your office computer from any internet connection. GoToMyPC, brought to you by Citrix, is the easiest remote access service available. Improve your work life and really create some balance with GoToMyPC. And in fact, you can try it free for 30 days. For this special offer, you have to visit www.gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free trial. And welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It is Andrew Horowitz here, your host, and you're listening to episode 98. We're going to dispense with some of the opening remarks here today, get right to our people that we have lined up today, because we have two very fascinating individuals, and we're going to be talking about Citibank and preferreds, and I brought together the people who are really in the know here. There's a lot going on when it comes to the banking industry, no kidding. None of it good, by the way, and all of it affecting you and I. And it is something that has, it's something that will hopefully never happen again. It is historic. It is enormous. It is monumental. And it is very, frankly, it's disgusting. I spent some time reading the great and powerful Oz, as I call it, the Warren Buffett annual report that was put out this weekend. And I'm going to share some of that with you because I want to talk about that, particularly with Mish. I want to get some questions to some things that I read on page 17 and 18 related to prostitutes, it seems, talking about venereal diseases, and you'll see what I mean in a minute when we get to it. That's his quote, not mine. I did want to mention to you that I've had many people, you know, writing me about what we could be doing for our 100th anniversary. I was thinking that'd be kind of cool. You know, if you could do me a favor, if you would write to me and tell me how you are or have become a disciplined investor, how you use the podcast, how you use the blog, how it's maybe hopefully helped you, and what you can say about it. We're going to find out what exactly we've done, hopefully to the benefit of people that are listening. And we're going to play those on the 100th anniversary. So just write to me to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Send me your commentary, send me your information, and we will pick a bunch of those out, give you a call, record some of those, and play them back. How you've become a disciplined investor. I hope you have, because it is no doubt saving you a lot of money, those disciplines and those strategies, and sticking to them, not just sticking to the old buy and hold strategy, has been something that has worked very well for our clients and for me personally, and I hope for you as well. So without further ado, let's get to our first discussion. And I thought that what we'd do is, I developed a really good relationship with a gentleman. His name is Vadya Zvinsky, and he writes a great blog. He's a very smart fellow. He and I became friends over the time that I did the MSN Strategy Lab. And I thought that I would give him a buzz and find out, because he did a lot of following of these preferreds, and find out what he had to say. And then we'll follow it right up Mike Shedlock from Citica Pacific, and talk with him about that. One last thing before we do that, I want to mention that if you haven't seen it yet, I was on CNBC a couple times the last few weeks. I did John Stewart, Microsoft Money. We did a download of about, I think, close to about 100,000 copies of the book were downloaded off of Microsoft. That was a great opportunity. And if you haven't, by the way, become a disciplined investor, now there is time. Go over to Amazon, $13.50. Even if it's a horrible book, pick up The Disciplined Investor and start on your road to becoming much more disciplined with your strategy and your investments. Let's hook this up. Let's get it on. We're going to get it on with Vadya Zvinsky in a moment with the magic of Skype once we get this hooked up. We'll be right back on The Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, as promised, we're going to have a great discussion today on something that is kind of way out right now past the minds of most investors because it's something that looks absolutely pathetic. You know, they have the name and they carry the name Preferred. Preferred stocks are an interesting play on an investment because they're kind of a hybrid between the equity of a company and the fixed income, whereas they carry a yield and at the same time they're traded on the New York Stock Exchange or other market. But preferred stocks have been under quite a battering and have had it beaten to a pulp recently. But a good friend of mine and a former competitor on the Strategy Lab from MSN, Vadya Zvinsky, is here with us. And he has the website, theskepticalcapitalist.com. I encourage you to go check that out. So, my friend Vod, how are you? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Listen, but just to let everybody know, Vod and I talk probably almost every night, every other night. And we have some great conversations about just a lot of things. I do my ranting. He calms me down. He does his ranting. I calm him down. Something like that, my friend, right?
It's a good arrangement. works quite well for both of us.
Exactly. So, you know, I thought we would do is we would have a conversation because back in the good old days of the Strategy Lab, we were messing around with preferreds before they started their real downward spiral. I mean, back in the day, way back about 3 or 4 months ago, we were talking about Royal Bank of Scotland and those particular preferreds, what they were doing. And there was a discussion about Cities and Bank of America's. And this week, we saw an interesting play by the Fed. They were going to take out the preferreds, convert them to common for Citi, not all of them, but some of them. And I thought we would have a discussion about, let's kind of a refresher about what preferreds are, how they operate, and maybe if there is some kind of a play here that is somewhat, let's just say, not hazardous to your health. So, Vod, let's start out with this. Explain to me like I'm an infant, okay? Tell me, you know, explain what a preferred is and maybe what it's not and who it's appropriate for, and then let's get into what's going on these days with preferreds.
Good deal. Basically, to sum it up, preferreds used to be an instrument that only retirees and people that were looking for income were looking at, and that was for one reason. The biggest reason for that was because the only real value of preferreds until very recently was their yield. So it was almost like buying a bond, but with a little higher yield and a little higher risk. But what happened recently, what we have seen, basically the preferred stock of the company is a hybrid, as you mentioned, of equity and debt. And it's issued predominantly by financial companies out there. It's an easiest way for them to raise capital if, for example, without diluting their common shareholders. So what the bank would do, they would go out and they would issue, for example, like Citicorp, they would go out and they issued $10 billion of preferred stock to, you know, the governments of, you know, to Abu Dhabi and Dubai and all of their, you know, Mideast, you know, government of Singapore, investment corp, and you know, up, you know, all the investors from the Middle East,
and this was because it was viewed as a safer part of the investment, and it carried a great yield. In fact, but back in, again, when I keep saying back in the day, before the whole entire financial world seemed to have imploded, there was something like, let's say you'd buy a preferred at like $25 a share, and that was par value, and let's say you'd get a 7% yield, and oftentimes, as a matter of fact, we found the recently, like Warren Buffett bought some of these, and he got a great deal from Goldman, a 10% yield on the preferred shares. And we saw Prince, I don't remember how to say his name, from, was it Saudi Arabia or, you know, the various, the richest guy in that whole region. He bought a bunch of these, and again, at a really good rate. But were those were different. Those were a different cut, not the general public brand, right?
Yeah, basically the big, the fund that all the type of prefers that all of us can invest in is their public kind. What they invested in, I think it was Al Waleed or whatever, I forgot the guy the guy's name was.
It was, but a Prince Mucky Mucky, whatever his name was. Yeah.
The reason they were invested in preferreds versus common is that preferred stays a little bit above in their, you know, in the capital structure of the common, and basically if there is a liquidation or bankruptcy, preferred will get shareholders will get compensated before any payments to the common shareholders, and also on the, and so that's one of the main reasons investors prefer to get their, you know, compensation in the form of preferred stock. Plus they carry a yield, And they're not necessarily – they're cutting dividend on your preferred stock is usually a sign of death for any company out there.
And a lot of these are issued by the financial firms because the financials were always looking for money, and they would pay you a percentage, of course, on the stock, and they would use it and loan it out and make some money with it. The other thing was that preferreds are – some preferreds, not all preferreds, are not all taxed at ordinary income tax rates. Rather, they were taxed at the dividend tax rate, the lower dividend tax rate. So one of the places, I don't know what you use for a website. I think that everybody, I know a site that I use and we'll put in the show notes, but Quantum Online is a great place to get information about preferreds. Is that, you have any other place that you use, Vod?
This is the core website I use. Quantum Online has a great, it's the best database that is out there that I found that is available to get all the information, links to all prospectuses, credit ratings, and you know all the detailed information. So Quantum Online is more than sufficient, in my opinion, to get any information as long as you search long enough.
But let me just and then I want to get into a discussion about maybe what the trade is on this and what this is all about. But let me just put up a gigantic red flag warning. This is like when you're on the beach and you the wind is blowing and you have those flags on the beach to see if there's a big giant undertow. There is a giant undertow, a monstrous, gigantic undertow when it comes to preferreds right now. And right now we saw preferreds that went from $25 down to $4. Now, what's interesting about them, if you take out your calculators, if there was, let's just make some round numbers, if there was a 5% yield, Vod, on a preferred, and that preferred at yield was at 25, of course, always at par value, and now it's trading at $5. If you buy that, what's your yield?
That's, 35, whatever percent.
Yeah. So now, if you buy that, now that should perk everybody's ears up. You get this great 35%. So essentially, what you get is a bit of an insurance contract, right? So you get some downside protection. That's what it used to be. The problem is these things are moving 20 and 30% a day. No kidding.
Correct.
So let's talk about some. Let's talk about what happened this week for Citi, and then get into maybe a discussion of Bank of America that you and I have been talking about trying to figure out if there's a good trade here. Let's talk about Citi.
Great.
Citi. Great. Let me just give the quick premise, and you go through the details. Citi was. I laugh because I've been watching the various testimonies, and Vikram Pandit, who is the CEO of Citi, says something to the effect of, "We are well capitalized. We are well capitalized. We are doing fine. We have no problems. Things are good. Our tier one assets are fantastic." And every time he seems to say that, another kind of wheel falls off, right?
That's right. That seemed to be the common theme. Every time somebody says we are fine, we don't need anything, especially if they put out a press release, that means they got issues.
Right. Wouldn't it be nice for somebody to say, "Oh man, we are sucking wind. I mean, we got a big problem." You think, maybe there's a company that's going to stay in existence for a little while longer, right?
Yeah, the only guy that seems to be able to get away with, saying, "Well, we have issues, we're going to have X, Y, and Z," is Jamie Dimon. But, the guy has so much I think everybody trusts in him like he's God. So
Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan, yeah.
Yeah, JP Morgan, it's almost facetious sometimes to look and watch. I mean, the reality of it is JP Morgan's balance sheet is, it's stronger than, say, B of A's, but it's not that much better. I mean, it's not that much stronger, but his reputation just makes all the difference.
Well, and unfortunately, that's going to only hold him so far. But let's talk about Citi. So Vikram Pandit says things are great. We've got to figure out what day we are in here. It's all starting to merge together. Last week, we saw the Fed come in and say they're going to take the preferreds, and they're going to convert them into common, and there was a formula. How'd that work?
So basically, here's the punchline. One of the main reasons the banks have been selling off recently, because every analyst, I'm kind of giving a little introduction, every analyst stopped paying attention to their normal, banking ratios, tier one, common equity, basically the leverage ratios. Nobody cares about that anymore. The only thing analysts seem to be caring about is the tangible common equity. So anything outside of goodwill and outside of preferred, basically preferreds do not count into tangible common equity.
Well, so what are they counting? I mean, is this where the mark-to-market issue is coming into play and where the problems are because they're looking at the values? But or is this they take the mark-to-market issues and put those aside because this is a much better looking number?
basically what they do is that one of the reasons the banks like to issue preferred is because they do count towards your Tier 1 ratio. So what happened when government had the first installment of TARP, it bumped up all the Tier 1 ratios across their industry. And the Tier 1 ratios, if you look at Tier 1 ratios, all the banks are very well capitalized. You know, even if you did mark-to-market, they're still, you know, they still would be well capitalized by FDIC definitions. But the problem with that is that, you know, that not all the equity is created equal. People in general do not give too much credit to preferred stock as a source of real equity. They like to see, like, tangible common equity buffer, you know, at least on the scale of 3 to 4%. And in the case of Citicorp, it was the tangible common equity was only 1.5% of their entire balance sheet, which is just extremely, extremely low. Mm-hmm. So what government is trying to do today, actually, I think based on what we hear, it's actually it came at their request of Citicorp, not at the request of the government. They basically trying to calm everybody down and said, okay, we're going to have $80 billion worth of common equity right now that we'll be able to use to soak up any losses that are going to come over the next 2 years. So what they're doing is they've taken all they've taken about $25 billion worth of their TARP money they pumped in their Citicorp back in November, and asking for $25-27 billion of you know, of private privately issued preferreds, you know, the ones that have been issued to Middle Eastern investors or to the public. And they're telling them, you take your preferreds and convert them into common Citi shares at the price of conversion price of three and a quarter a share. Mm-hmm. And so if at the time they did it, I think the Citicorp was trading whatever, you know, I'd say, you know, $2.
Right.
So basically it was, you know, 30, you know, actually it was a little higher. So it was like a 30% premium.
So what happened was, just to get to the bottom so we don't bore to death the people with all these numbers, the bottom line is that we saw this great pop on the many of the Citibank preferreds. Now, let's kind of translate that. At the same time, by the way, we saw a real fizzle when it came to Citigroup stock. I mean, down about, I don't know, last week it ended up the week down at about 150. I don't know where it started the week, but it's down. It's at a, you know, a low, low, low. And in fact, you know, down about 40% just on Friday alone, it was down about 40%. But here's the question. This looks like what could, if you could model this, and it's something they're going to do. I don't know how much of this is an interim step, because this is going to save, I think the number was something like, was it $9 billion of expenses from savings on dividends? There's a tremendous, tremendous savings.
It's about 50 billion times, you know, an average coupon, 6-7 billion. So that, you know, that kind of gives you a number. It's probably 3.5 billion or so in worth of dividends they don't have to pay.
Okay, so that's a lot of money. Now, if you take this and you then model this accordingly to other companies, let's look at Bank of America, which looks like it's second in line, and let's not get to the next juncture, which could be like what's going to happen next to these companies. Let's just stay right here for the moment, okay? Would it be an interesting play to short Bank of America and go long some of the preferreds that are the equivalent to the Citi preferreds in terms of structure and whether they're cumulative and et cetera? Or is that dangerous?
The math here is such that if B of A preferreds get to the same point in the form of the discount to where Citi preferreds were trading before the announcement, you know, let's not forget Citi's preps were trading at, you know, at $4 and the $25 notional value, $5. So, you know, it's 20 cents on the dollar. So what happened after they did basically forgetting all the math, that, I mean, right now they're worth double that because, you know, they can, after the transaction is complete, they can actually sell their common shares on the open market, plus their trust preferreds, they're still paying the dividend. If B of A preferreds indeed go down to that level, you know, 25, 30 cents on the dollar, assuming conversion is somewhere on the, you know, somewhere in the same neighborhood, I think it could be a very interesting play. But the only thing there is you need to watch out and look at the specific series, because in the case of Citicorp, the ones that really benefited were the perpetual preferreds, not the trust preferreds.
So the bottom line is the way you can get nailed is if somehow they both go down. But what you could do from there is maybe buy something like an SKF or a put on something, or you can kind of hedge a little bit more. But there is an interesting play here. The part Absolutely. That's a problem, though, is you can't rely on this income. Now, I'll tell you what really aggravates me. To a point that puts me way over the edge here, and I guess this is something that we're just going to have to live with, and we're going to have to kind of one of those things you have to deal with. You know, I've been in this business 25 years, and when I think of preferreds, and when I kind of can recall looking at statements and people who I've seen in life and, you know, come across in life, you know, who was it that owned the preferreds? It was usually the, you know, the mom and pops, the grandmas, the grandpas that were retired, that, you know, got some kind of retirement payout. And what they do with it, they simply, you know, bought some preferreds, they bought some blue chips, and they wanted the yield. They weren't looking for anything dramatic. They weren't chasing junk. But now, all of a sudden, they're saddled with this situation where they have a possible, you know, situation where it's going to be belly up. And I don't mind so much, as crazy as it may sound, but, you know, if you bought preferreds and you were maybe a bit younger, or if you only had them for a portion of your portfolio, by the way, okay, I could deal with that. But the amount of preferreds that some of these brokers put upon, you know, these investors is, it's really a shame. It's very disheartening.
It's very, very disheartening. And I think another point to mention, I mean, not only retirees, you know, who's the largest holder of preferreds is?
Well, this is an interesting discussion. This is interesting.
It's the insurance companies all around the country.
And they got downgraded last week by Standard & Poor's, I believe, or Moody's or Standard & Poor's downgraded them last week. And what's interesting there is that we saw a few other interesting downgrades. How much is GE? GE cracked down to $8.50, I think it was, at the end of the day, at the end of the week last week. And, I mean, just like, wow. I mean, really, quite incredible. GE drops their dividend by about 80%. By the way, the stock immediately goes up, then goes right back down, then comes back up, then goes back down again. Like, you know, because of the uncertainty of what does this mean? I think, tell me what you think about this. I think that gives the green light to companies to cut their dividends. What do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what we've seen with GE, what happened with GE last week, or the reason we saw that seesaw kind of zigzag reaction was that, you know, everybody, don't forget, there were two concerns with GE. One is their dividend. The second one is the credit rating. And to me, credit rating is a lot more important because that impacts their business.
But by decreasing the dividend, they did it to keep their credit rating. As a matter of fact, it was confirmed last week, at least from last week, that the credit rating was going to hold.
Correct. They're not going to be decreased. But here's the reason it can't. So, and that's the reason stock went up initially. But then Moody's and S&P immediately came out and said their outlook, they're not changing their outlook. And every time, and their outlook on the stock is negative on the credit rating. What that means, negative outlook means that within 2 months, historically, there comes a downgrade. So within the next 2 months, there is almost, I mean, I'm not saying a 90% certainty, but statistically, probably 80% probability GE will lose their rating. Because they did not change the outlook today, and that's the reason stocks kept trailing down even though they cut the dividend.
All right, we're going to switch gears because there's a lot of misery, a lot of pain, a lot of problems, a lot of concern. We got that out. Let's kind of move into, again, as it sounds a little bit crazy. Actually, before we do that, let's cover one more area that's a concern of mine. I was on the plane last week and the week before. I was on a plane. I shot up to New York and back very quickly for a day trip. And
did we see you on that plane? Were you one of the guys that were trying to get out? Then, you know, the one in the Hudson River?
That was a few weeks before, actually. But no, I was the guy on the wing. It was kind of warm inside there. But seriously, listen. So I was on JetBlue, which was great. So I was able to watch both times. I happened to be on the plane at just the right time where President Obama was giving some speeches. And I wrote, as a matter of fact, for the private client blog for the Disciplined Investor Growth Managed Growth Strategy, we put that up this week, all my discussion. And as a matter of fact, one of them was during trading hours and one of them wasn't. And so one of them, I wrote, and as I wrote, I commented about what was being discussed, and at the same time, I wrote down what was happening with the markets, okay? And that was kind of an interesting thing. As a matter of fact, anybody that If you haven't done so, you know, this is just based for our clients. We like this transparency. We like to give, you know, full open discussion about what we're doing and our you know, the things that we do good, things that we don't do so well, the real victories and the real the defeats, if you will, in the markets. And we have this just for our clients. If anybody is thinking about investing and doing a thing with the TDI Managed Growth, if you want a 10-day free trial, just send an email to trials@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll be happy to set you up for a 10-day freebie. You can kind of take a peek at what we're doing inside of there. It's kind of cool. But so I wrote this whole thing. What is going on with President Obama's speeches? Don't you think it's about time for him to get a new speechwriter?
I do not know what are they doing, but every time I know that he's coming, I'm hedging right before his speech, because every time he's, I mean, since he became president, actually, you know, his acceptance, actually, since his acceptance speech, I mean, this has been just a disaster. Every time he comes to the TV, the thing's just, I mean, everything drops off the floor, either him or Geithner. I mean, neither one, I mean, I do not know what's going on, but something's...
Well, the problem is that he's continuing to give his rah-rah, sis-boom-bah campaign speech without any clarity, and the last thing that he talked about with kind of sticking it to the rich, and I had some real good thoughts on, as a matter of fact, I wrote this, so anybody that wants to check this out, what I wrote, it's in the blog, definitely come on over. What I thought was really interesting was that they're going to go after the rich. They're going to you know, do what they can to clean the situation up. But I got to tell you, it looks like he is going for, you know, he's going for the jugular. That's the bottom line. He's going for the jugular here. But the question is, and what I'm asking you is his $3.6 billion, is his $3.6 trillion budget appropriate on top of the $1 trillion or so bailout, on top of the trillions of dollars that's been spent already? Is this going to actually get us to where we want to be, or is this another kind of temporary setback that's going to cause more problems?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. It's actually kind of a tricky question. I'm very much so. I mean, I've been very disappointed with what started. I mean, everybody was kind of, you know, thinking, okay, the guy is smart, so things might get a little, you know, we'll see. We need to give him time.
Or said another way, anything is better than Bush. But go ahead.
Okay, I'll take that. But I mean, the disaster that they've been putting out there for the last 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, it's just been, I mean, nothing has made any kind of sense. I mean, the stimulus package is not really a stimulus package. I have no clue, just a bunch of Medicare spending, a bunch of, you know, education and stuff that is not necessarily, I'm not saying it's bad, but in the short run, it's not going to stimulate anything. And then, you know, his mortgage giveaway, I mean, that's a disaster. Mm-hmm. And then their whole rhetoric towards healthcare sector. You know, here's what this week I thought we had their, you know, sort of temporary bottom. I'm not sure it's an all-time bottom. I thought we're there. And then for the next 2 days, President Obama came out and basically hammered the market twice.
Yeah.
First for the healthcare companies, and then second time, and all the multinationals. Don't forget, they're trying to, I mean, I cannot believe during the recession, the worst recession since Great Depression, we are talking about raising damn taxes on businesses.
And we're talking protectionism when we need the money from the other places. And we're talking about, you know, curtailing, not giving a good credit for people that earn too much. And there's just a whole bunch of things that are very contradictory. But now is where I want to get into. Where is the positive? There's got to be somewhere where we can invest, not just short. There's got to be somewhere where we can invest and we can make some money. There's got to be a bright light somewhere, just something. What is it? It's got to be. What do you think?
Ultra short treasuries.
Oh,
TBT.
All right. Besides that. And by the way, we're short gold, and we finally closed that position. We closed TBT for about an $8 gain, and we actually we're still short gold. But
here's what I've been buying over the last few days.
And yeah, tell me.
I have two areas that I focus on right now, given that nothing really works. I've been focusing on closed-end ETFs that sell at large discounts that employ buy-right feature.
Basically, give me some examples.
My favorites ones are EXG, IGD, QQQX, and EOS. Those are four. I mean, I have about six or seven of them on the list. I can give you the names. You can put them
up on the website. Just send them over to me, and we'll put them up on the website.
Great. And then on the prefs, I also focus on their names that are stronger, and I'm focusing on their more senior types of preferreds, more like exchange-traded debt.
So when, like, you, when you go to Quantum Online, do you have a filter that you use? Because there's a filtering availability there.
Yeah. You can basically look for what they call exchange traded debt securities, and it's actually one of the options when you go into income tables. You know, when you register, it's a free registration, but you go in there and it shows you, you know, either trust preferred securities or exchange traded income securities, basically stuff that is senior to like a normal preferred stock.
Right.
And what I've been focusing on buying some prefs for some the large European insurance company called Allianz.
Oh yeah, sure.
It's actually the largest insurer in the world right now outside of China Life. They just reported their numbers. There were insurance. I mean, their solvency ratios are good. And they, by the way, they're a parent of PIMCO. So we know PIMCO got government's ear, so they'll be fine. And that thing is yielding about 16% right now. And
but how do you protect yourself? Because these things are moving wildly, and I don't trust the insurance. But, I mean, did you see what happened with Hartford? What a disaster that was.
Correct.
I mean,
correct.
They come out and say there's all sorts of problems. You and I talked about the possible put at 850. Boy, that was a long time ago, wasn't it? On the S&P 850. And then they came out and said, no, that's not what it is. And remember what happened? Did we talk about this? Did we talk about the change? About I got to tell everybody, if you haven't heard, this is unbelievable. So what happened was that the insurance companies were having a problem with the reserves. And what happens is that there's a certain amount of money they have to put away and aside as backup, as reserves, to make sure that they can pay their life insurance death benefits, right? And they assume that people are going to die at a certain age, depending on their health. We call that mortality tables. And the mortality tables, way back when, there was a table that said, okay, you were age 22, you're going to live this long, you're age 45, you're going to live this long, at least statistically. Well, what happened was, this is really fascinating, there was the 1958 CSO, the Commissioner's Standard Orderly, okay? That was the table that showed us when people would live and die. Then we had the 1980 CSO. It was a little bit longer, people living a little bit longer, and therefore we had to correct and provide a better a table. And in fact, what happened there was that insurance premiums came down because people are living longer, they could pay it over a period of time that's a bit longer. Well, recently what happened was that, and if you think about it, by the way, the longer people live, the less reserves a company will have to have, because people are going to be living a longer period of time. Does that make sense? So now what happened was that the insurance companies were having all sorts of problems, from the really bad investments that they made to the fact that people weren't paying their premiums anymore. There's just an enormous amount of problems, okay? So what they do? Well, they had to figure a way that they can save some money. Well, the insurance commissioners came down and decided they're going to change to the 2000 CSO, which is another extension of life, and people are paying less in premiums. But what they did was for the calculation of reserve requirements, they're assuming people live to the ripe old age of 120.
I mean, this is almost a joke, and that's
unbelievable. Now, I'm pretty sure I got this from a really good source, and I did some research. I found that, but I got to tell you something. You know, it's what it was. Jerry Lewis had a movie called, you know, "Don't Raise the Bridge, Lower the Water." I mean, this is what we're talking about, constantly reducing standards, requirements are changing. I remember this story that, you know, there was water that they said that, you know, 10 parts per million was all that was allowed from this particular substance. If it was higher than that, you couldn't drink the water. It was considered dirty, poisonous, whatever it was. Well, what happened was over the years that all of a sudden the water had a lot more pollutants in it. So now that went to about 14 parts per million. So instead of saying that, no, don't drink the water, they just changed the safety requirement, saying 20 parts per million is the amount that's really dangerous now. And it's this constant, you know, butchering of our ideals and our goals. That's the thing that's really a problem right now. Insurance companies are bad. So I'm still searching. Give me something good. Healthcare. Anything in healthcare.
Here's an important part about it. All the preferreds. All the preferreds come with a lot of risk. The reason I like Allianz, and that's the only insurance company that I actually buy anything off, is they're not life insurer. They're property and casualty, which their business is a lot. Their business is a lot more stable than life insurance.
But also, anyway, they do a lot of annuities. They have a lot of annuities too.
They have some in U.S., but their main business is they actually have all over the world, and their business is in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I like preferreds of U.S. Bank. I think U.S. Bank is one of the banks that is probably going to give the TARP money back quite, I mean, not soon, but I mean, if they cut the dividend, they probably can do it this year. But U.S. Bank is probably one of the safest banks, in my opinion.
U.S. Bank Corp. Now, this is the same U.S. Bank Corp that I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that recently was sold by Warren Buffett in Berkshire Hathaway. Was that? Am I correct in saying that?
He cut down very, very little. I mean, he still kept a large part. And the reality of it, U.S. Bank is one of the only few banks that is trading at their premium to their book, which is a big deal, which basically an indicator market believes they're going to earn more than they're going to lose. And the reason I like U.S. Bank is I used to work in a large payment processor, and what people don't realize, U.S. Bank has probably a third of their business, if not they're close to half, comes from a business that is sort of like a MasterCard transaction processing revenues, which are not necessarily, actually, they're not suffering from credit losses on that part. And so right. It's a very stable annuity-like income that is helping them to diversify and pay their dividend, and you know, it's helping out their rating.
Okay, what about, give me some other names. I mean, you know, we've talked about a variety of things. Give me some things that just rattle off some names that you like.
If we're focusing on preferreds.
Forget the preferreds. Well, we're talking about, you know, preferreds are really, let's also admit they're really dangerous right now.
Absolutely.
They're really, really dangerous. If you can come up with a hedging process that's interesting, you can't count on, I don't think, I mean, we're gonna actually work some preferreds in the next couple of weeks in our portfolios, but on a trading basis.
Yeah, and that's sort of the way I've been using them. As far as the names, the individual names, GOI. It's still my favorite, one of my favorite ideas.
That's the satellite company, right?
Satellite company. Uh-huh. They just got approved by NGA.
They had a nice week. I saw a couple of days. They had some nice numbers they put up.
That's right, and they're actually one of the few stocks that were up pretty much every day over the last few weeks. And
what about Dolby? Dolby? That's an inside joke.
I know where you're hitting, but the answer is not so much.
Okay.
Not so much.
What about the technology stocks? You like any of those names? Do you like, I don't know, you like Apple? You like RIM? You like Baidu? You like Google? Any of those things?
I like Baidu, and I actually, Baidu is one of, I sell, you see what, I'm going for a little safer route right now. I'm not necessarily buying the names. I'm selling puts against them, naked puts. 20-30% below the current price, and then
just to explain what this means is basically what you're doing is you're selling puts, these are options, with the idea that if a stock is, let's say, at 100 now and you sell the put for 75, you get a little premium in. But basically, if it gets down there, your risk is that you'll have to buy the stock at the lower prices. So these are stocks that you already like, and you're just setting it up that you'll be willing to take it at a much lower price, plus taking some of the premium now.
Absolutely, and that's what I've been doing. I sold some puts. I actually own puts on Baidu. I own puts on MasterCard, strangely enough, because the premiums are just insane. I have, I sold puts on, today I sold puts on GE, finally, you know, with our 750s March. And then I sold, I have puts on GOI. I have puts on Frontier Oil. I am looking into some puts on some other smaller names. But basically, I have a pretty diversified portfolio of puts. None of them can really hurt me, but I and then if stocks like GOI keeps going up, I basically up my put strike prices and, you know, sell
collect the premium and take it out. Yeah. So is there any sectors that you think are the next shoe to fall? I mean, we've been hearing commercial real estate. I told you that I was short gold. Far so good. We're there. We shorted Hewlett Packard, a few of the technologies, make some money there. It's tough these days to short. I'm getting a little nervous because I'm figuring there's going to be some kind of a massive rally somewhere in all of this. You know, for good or bad reason, it's going to happen. Anything else that sticks out? Healthcare? Okay, how about this? How about the agricultural stocks? There was a rumor last week about Mosaic being taken out, being bought
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. I was running my screeners, and we talked about it, me and you, about maybe 2 weeks ago. So you remember I said two names that kept popping up on pretty much every screen I run were CF and CF Industries and Mosaic. I wasn't sure why, but every screen I run, all of my fundamental screeners, technical screeners, everything was popping up with CF and Mosaic. And here we go, bingo. This week, CF, Terra Industries made a bid for CF. That thing went up, 20% in the day. And then Mosaic now is being rumored to be taken over.
Rumor, we need to be careful because it was a small blog that rumored it up. So I am concerned about that. But I'll tell you what I said And I've said this before, and I'll say it again, is that we have to eat. The only problem is we tried to, you know, nibble on some mosaic, and it got ugly very quickly. And, you know, the question, you know, the problem is these things are going to be very volatile. And, you know, I think the name of the game right now is that you have to be still be very nimble. You have to be very, you know, watching your stops. And let me give you a little rule for the road on the stops. Tell me what you think about this. You draw a trend line and you draw your support levels. And when it comes to the stops, you find where those stop levels you think are most appropriate, and then you back them off. You take it down to the next part where you think that most investors are going to be stopping out. And then from there, you back it off even a little bit more, even lower, because right now the problem is that things are moving very, very fast and you can get stopped out. The second thing that we're doing is if we normally would have a 10% stop on a position, okay? So we have a stock that has a 5% position in a portfolio, and we have a 10% sell stop on it, okay? Instead of doing that, what we're doing is, this may sound a little crazy, but follow me here, we're entering into a 2.5% position and opening up our stops even wider.
Because, that's right.
You know, that makes sense to you?
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, because we want to be in something, whether it's short or long, and we want to be there, but at the same time, we figure that there's going to be some pretty wide-ranging volatility that we don't want to be a part of. All right, parting words, my friend. Anything else that you want to say that you could think of that may be beneficial for our listeners?
One more name that actually started popping up about a week or so ago on a lot of screeners on the same. I'm not sure what's cooking there, but something is cooking for sure. It's their little Mercado Calibre, which is Latin America eBay. eBay of Latin America, and they are developing a little platform sort of like PayPal. eBay owns 20% of them. It's called, the stock symbol is Meli, M-E-L-I. Something is cooking there. That thing was looking like it's going to pop. I'm not sure. I'm not saying it will, but just a name to look at. Because,
and, of course, don't take any tips. Nobody should take any tips.
Yeah, none of this stuff is recommendation. It's right. My opinions on the way I see things.
Well, we got a lot of good information there, things to review, and I want to thank you. If anybody has any interest, go over to theskepticalcapitalist.com. We'll put a link on the show notes, of course. And Vod, I do appreciate it, and you check it out. By the way, Vod and I wrote an article we worked together on, the recent article about questioning whether or not Warren Buffett was getting margin calls, which brought in a lot of interesting comments. And if you haven't seen that yet, we wrote that. We talked about that, about what was inside the portfolio. And thanks again for that that good insight that you gave me. Appreciate it.
No problem.
All right, buddy, anytime. We'll talk to you shortly. And I think it's my turn tomorrow night to rant and you listen, right?
Sounds good. that's the way it usually is on the weekends.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a Monday kind of guy.
I hear you. All right, buddy, I'll see you soon. Thanks so much for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Anytime. Thank you much.
And we are back. We are talking with Mike Shedlock, known as Mish, who is with Sitka Pacific. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
Thanks. Now, I was reading this weekend, as everybody does, curls up in their bed when it's nice and either cold or warm outside, I suppose, on a fine day after Warren Buffett comes out with his massive annual letter. And I found a lot of things that were really interesting in here. And of course, we could talk about how there was a 97% loss and all these terrible things that happened, specifically related to derivatives. But there was one line, page 17, if anybody's following along at home, page 17, 18. And I want to read this to you about derivatives, Mish. It says, derivative contracts, in contrast, often go unsettled for years as opposed to regular stock or even decades, with counterparties building up huge claims against each other. And then he goes on to say, a frightening web of mutual dependence develops among huge financial institutions. Receivables and payables by the billions become concentrated in the hands of a few large dealers who are apt to be highly leveraged in other ways as well. Participants seeking to dodge troubles face the same problem as some seeking to avoid venereal disease. It's not just whom you sleep with, but also whom they are sleeping with. In other words, you're talking about how you have to watch everybody because everybody's interrelated here. But he continues on.
That's a great quote, and that's exactly what happened. We had AIG and J.P. Morgan, and we had Lehman and Bear Stearns all interrelated in such a way. They let – actually, no one let Lehman fail. Lehman just failed.
Yeah.
but Lehman failed. And the reason why they didn't attempt to intervene with Lehman like they did with some of the others was just because the credit derivatives on Lehman were easier to straighten out. That's what I believe. I can't prove that, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Even still, that Lehman spooked them. And now we have them, the government, still trying to untangle AIG, a huge mistake. And they're trying to untangle Citigroup right now. And I don't believe it can be done.
Question is, who's next? But he goes on, and let me just continue this metaphor. This is where it really gets interesting. He says, sleeping around, to continue our metaphor, can actually be useful for large derivative dealers because it assures them government aid if trouble hits. In other words, only companies having problems that can infect the entire neighborhood, I won't mention names, he says, are certain to become a certain of the state. An outcome, I'm too sad to say, that is proper. From this irritating reality comes the first law of corporate survival for ambitious CEOs who pile on leverage and run large and unfathomable derivatives books. Modest incompetence simply won't do. It's mind-boggling screw-ups that are required. I mean, basically, what he was saying is, Buffett is saying that, you know, in this world with derivatives, the more you pile on, the more wackier deals you do, the more the potential to harm and cause systematic risk to our system, the better off you are because you will get bailed out if all hell breaks loose.
See, I disagree with him on that. And there was another point in there that he said that I'm trying to remember that I disagreed with him. Oh, he said that he agreed with bailing them out. I disagree.
Well, I don't know if he said
bailing out these institutions at all. What would happen? Have you ever asked yourself, what would happen? Exactly what, you know, so Lehman went bankrupt. The world didn't end. What would happen if Citigroup did? I propose nothing. You would get up tomorrow. Nothing would happen to you. The average person at Walmart would get up tomorrow and nothing would happen to them. They'd still go into work. What would change?
Well,
let's talk about that.
Well, what we know, first of all, is that it will have a profound effect on credit markets. We agree with that?
I'm not sure that it would. Look at the effect on the credit markets right now. Banks don't want to lend. Consumers and businesses don't want to borrow. What's the difference?
So basically, what you're saying is,
what happened after Lehman went bankrupt?
Right. What you're saying is that the credit markets squeezed up a little bit on the higher end, on the higher side. They weren't lending to each other. Forget about the business to consumer now. I'm talking about the business to business. No longer were counterparties trusting each other. Which, by the way,
They still don't.
Right.
Without the Fed intervention here, guaranteeing every contract between everyone, still not lending.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about a lending. It seems to me, and this is something that has been on my mind, every time I hear a speech by Obama or President Obama or someone in charge talks about how we got to get the credit markets running again, got to get them smoothly moving again and operating, and that's the heart of our economy. The consumers need credit. This is what we hear, right?
That is what we hear, yes.
We hear this. My question is, and this is somehow, it baffles me, isn't that exactly what got us into trouble was the misuse and the overindulgence of credit all these years? And what are we saying? Are we saying that we need to go back to that, at least for a little while? We need to kind of get the drug back in the system for a little while in order to make the economy run? Because it seems to me that if we can't afford things right now, maybe we shouldn't buy them.
That's what's misguided about all this calls for regulation. I was very disappointed. I saw Bill Maher real time over the weekend, and he had three panelists, one from the Financial Times, who was the person I was most upset with, you know, hearing that someone from the Financial Times would come up with this view. Ron Paul was on for a few minutes, and Ron Paul gave his statement about, you know, the government ought to get out of the way, leave things alone.
Right.
And this person from the Financial Times was on the panel, along with a U.S. House of Representative member, and a third person who I forgot. But all three of these, there were three women on the panel, and the person from the Financial Times said, well, what we need to do, it would be scary. It would be scary if we let these banks fail. You know, no one's ever tried that. Well, here we keep stacking on regulation after regulation. It was regulation that created Fannie Mae. And so now we're expecting regulation to fix it. But what are they doing? You look at Fannie Mae. They're trying to get Fannie Mae to lend more. If you look at what's going on in Congress, they're all talking about the need to get rid of Fannie Mae and unwind it. And that needs to be done, but they're doing the opposite.
Yeah,
and
no,
that is the problem with the regulation. We had, and it's just what you said, we have a problem with excessive lending for no reason, yet the government solution is, ding, 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 we need more lending. And I keep asking the question, for what? And I keep coming up with no answers, because we don't need any more Pizza Huts, Walmarts, nail salons, Home Depots, Lowe's, or anything else that I can think of. We don't need more auto dealerships. And that's another thing. The government's trying to prevent these auto dealerships from going bankrupt. It's impossible.
Well, and then we have the problem.
Dealerships are going to go bankrupt.
Listen, we have this is the most mind-boggling thing. Everybody, I don't care what level of sophistication you have in terms of your knowledge of the economics or the business markets and the stock exchanges, we all know that the housing market is in bad shape. Let's just use that. Yet, at the same time, builders are still building. And you know what I always say? I say builders are like puppy dogs.
And they're asking for more credit from the government to build. Exactly.
Unbelievable. I always say that builders are like puppy dogs. Puppy dogs will eat until they throw up. Builders will build until they're bankrupt. That's all they do. Builders, their job is to build. That's their job. They don't have another job.
They will build as long as they have money to build.
Right, it doesn't
matter. And they're asking for more money to build and more guarantees. And the government gave them not guarantees, but they what they do? They increase the what's that called?
They increase the tax benefit for first-time home builders.
Yeah. The tax benefit. Yeah. Let's get back to Buffett though, because we didn't finish up here.
I want to finish on
Warren Buffett. Here, Buffett has railed against the use of all these derivatives, and what did he go out and do exactly the same thing himself? Not only that, his timing was incredibly bad.
Yeah.
He's never claimed to be, to have good market timing. But good Lord, we're talking about doing something, what he did, right as we're heading into a recession.
Everyone
should have been able to see this recession coming. Buffett had to see this recession coming. If he didn't see this recession coming, then that says something about the competency of Warren Buffett. Because when you have a yield curve invert for as long as it did, and you have these credit conditions start to contract, it's clear that a recession was coming. So rather than wait for the bottom, Buffett went out and sold all these puts on the S&P and the FTSE in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's $10 billion in the hole on these things, and yet he says he blamed himself in the report.
Yes, he took
responsibility.
For a couple
of things he did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
For he blamed himself for buying more, what was this, Phillips Conical?
Yep, at the wrong time.
And he said that was a huge mistake. Well, at least we know that Phillips Conical, I hope, it's not going to zero anytime soon.
Right.
So Phillips Conical might bounce back. But when he sells these puts on the index, although we know the index is not going to zero, there are many companies in there that are. I mean, look at Citigroup. It's trading at, what, a buck and change now? The Bank of America is well under five. Technically, these companies need to be kicked out of the Dow. Isn't there a price limit of $10
or
something?
No, absolutely. There is. But what's interesting, if you read through this, I found this. I don't often read the Buffett and the Berkshire Hathaway report on an annual basis, but there were some really interesting things in here. For example, what I thought was really fascinating was there's a whole section, which I'm sure he does every single year, whereas we go to the annual meeting, and he talks about all the companies that will be there that represent, that Berkshire Hathaway owns, of course. And he talks about how all these, benefits and go there and come and spend money. Come there expecting to spend a lot of money because we want our companies to do well, that we do a lot of revenue and we do a lot of sales that year. We're setting up shop. They're going to use Geico's going to be there, one of their insurance companies that has done very well, and they want you to buy your car insurance from them, et cetera. I'm thinking they're going to have all these different companies there that are selling their wares. Does he really believe that people are going to open up their wallets this year to spend all such a money? Is it that? Maybe it is. Maybe it's that much of a cult. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I don't really understand how this whole thing works with them. But what is more important, and you mentioned this, was, we just posted a, I think we'll do everybody a lot of justice to see what's actually inside the portfolio of Berkshire Hathaway. If you look at that, and if you didn't know it was Warren Buffett, I've said this before, you would be horrified. As a matter of fact, on our site, I'll put a link to that in this podcast notes. You need to take a look. We have a snapshot as of last week of what is inside the Berkshire Hathaway portfolio. It's insurance companies. It's financials. It's just a whole host of things that are in the toilet, frankly. But
exactly,
what's unbelievable.
And here, Buffett has been bailed out over all. People thought he was a god. Well, he really, if you look at it and analyze it closely, now he did make some good times, good bets, had good times, and his buy and hold strategy certainly worked for the period in which he was out there. But let's face it, 1980 to 2000, you couldn't go wrong by holding almost anything.
Yeah.
And especially dividend paying companies, you know, you plow back the dividends in there. On the share prices kept rising. Companies were ridiculously buying back shares at incredibly high. How much did Citigroup, by the way? How many hundreds of billions of dollars did Citigroup waste buying shares of itself back? GE did the same, by the way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to Buffett again. His claim when he sold these derivatives is it frees up cash for investment. That I just have to take him to task for that. Selling puts does not free up cash for investment. Now, his claim is that, well, he doesn't have to, by contract, tie up any money. Well, whether he has to do it by contract or not, he's $10 billion in the hole. Now, yeah, he can survive that because he's got a lot of cash on the books, on his balance sheet. So he can survive this, whereas AMBAC, MBIA, and some of these other companies that did essentially the same thing as what he did are not going to survive.
Right.
But just because he survives doesn't mean it was a good bet. But more importantly, he just doesn't understand the construct that selling puts that doesn't free up cash.
Well, he's talking about that, the money that they take in.
For that.
Well, he talks about the money they're taking in and that the money is available and any of the derivatives that they utilize are not going to be required to have any margin or collateral. He won't do it, and that's what he discussed in here.
Exactly. That's it. Now, whether he says that contractually he has to have that or not, the point of the fact is he's $10 billion in the hole
right.
on this.
No question. And it basically took his entire profit and just obliterated it. He also mentioned a couple other things that was interesting. First of all, let me say something. I want to tell you something. One of the things that he discusses is he does say that he made some acts of omission and commission. He talks about he made some mistakes. Whether or not the derivative bet or any of the other buys or sells that he did inside of Berkshire Hathaway were right or wrong,
it was a mistake.
It's fine.
No matter how it turns out.
I agree. But hear me out for a second.
His timing was so bad doing it at that point in the recession that regardless of how well it turned out, it was a mistake. I'm sorry. That's how
biggest,
I'm looking at it.
It's
a $10 billion mistake as of this point. Because if he did it right now, he could actually, quote, in his terms, free up $10 billion worth of cash.
But
instead, he freed up $4.5 billion, and he's $10 billion in the hole doing it.
Right, but a bigger issue. That was an issue that was a plague upon his own house. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger issue was his outright, open and loud blabbering about it is time to buy American and time to buy stocks. Remember that back in October.
He bought American Express and what, Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, but and then by the way, you know what the discussion going around now is that, you know what, he may have bought maybe Citibank and Goldman, and you know the dividend is being cut by Citi, not his. If he has preferreds in that special deal he cut with Citi, they're not going to cut his preferreds, right?
I'm not so sure. If they stop paying dividends on preferred,
not on all.
He's out.
Not on all.
We need to see that. I bet that they stop paying dividends on those prefers. But what that was a sweetheart deal meant given only available to Buffett, actually. It was a publicity stunt to try and raise the prices of the stock. Now whether Buffett escapes on that, I don't think he will, actually, because I think all that's going to be wiped out. the especially on Citigroup, you know, maybe he survives Bank of America. Citigroup's not going to survive. It's clear right now that Citigroup's not going to survive.
But if you look at what happened last week with Citigroup, there was a number of preferreds that did not do so well, and those were the ones that were not being priced. There was a few. My understanding is that not every single preferred, there's only a certain grouping of preferreds that were going to be taken out and converted to common, not all of them.
Well, that's because the government didn't do all of it. But I don't know about these others. I guess we have to wait and see how well those preferreds do.
Right.
But just watch, because I think we're in the process of totally dismantling Citigroup, where all the preferred, all the common is wiped out, and a substantial portion of the bondholders are wiped out too.
So let's talk about this. So let's get off the Buffett train, and we only have a couple of minutes. Trying to keep is kind of short today, but let me ask you this. Is there a trade in this kind of situation where we saw Citibank see the preferreds come out, but yet they bought the preferreds at above market? So they, if theoretically, if the day before this whole thing went down, you would have gone long the preferreds and gone short the stock, that would have been a great deal for you. That would have been a nice situation. Is that at all possible for Bank of America, let's say, or Wells Fargo, or anybody else out there? Is that a trade that we could look at, or is it just way too dangerous to be even anything near these things?
I would say that it's not it's dangerous to be playing with them at all. I wouldn't advise that. And actually, I think the picture now, I talked about it on my blog here, of what is actually happening and why the government is so resistant to nationalizing Citigroup. And the answer came out this weekend. I was talking to Michael Mandel. He's the chief economist for Business Week. I was at a conference at the Kauffman Foundation this last week for 3 days, and I talked with him extensively. I wrote about it on my blog. And the reason has to be that a great repudiation is coming, and that's how Mandel described it, where at some point, the bondholders are going to take a big haircut. And what's happening in the meantime is, and the reason why the U.S. government does not want to have nationalized Citigroup at that point when it happens, because the foreign governments that own a lot of these bonds, that own a lot of the debt that's on the balance sheets of Citigroup, is that debt's going to be repudiated. If the U.S. government has nationalized that, they're going to expect to be bailed out. If they, yep. if Citigroup is not nationalized, well, then all the bondholders get a hit, and they can't go to the government to scream. Now, most likely, they're going to go to the government, the U.S. government, and scream anyway. But that seems to me to be exactly what's happening. In other words, we're boiling these frogs in order. First, we wiped out the common holders. Then we wiped out the preferred holders, and the U.S. had to wipe out its own preferred debt in that to placate the common holders of Abu Dhabi and Singapore that invested in Citigroup at insanely ridiculous prices now in retrospect, some at $30, some at $15 a share. Citigroup's at $1 a share now. So in order to placate them, the U.S. government had to wipe out at taxpayer expense, it's $45 billion of preferred. So now that the common and the preferred is wiped out, we're going to see a great repudiation here on the bondholders. Mm. They're going to do this stress test. Citigroup's going to fail.
Oh.
They're going to have
But you're not going to know about the stress test. You're not going to know about the stress test because the government has told us that the public is not going to be informed about the results of the stress test. How do you like that?
Oh, I know that. So, you know, that's another thing that's actually weighing on the markets. But just in, as it comes to Citigroup, they will probably break up. I think a breakup of Citigroup is coming here now, where they're going to have to sell this off in pieces and screw the bondholders, and that'll be that. Now, whether or not that cascades any forward onto Bank of America, but if you look at the share price of its stock, it's certainly acting sick. But a lot of that Bank of America brought on itself. Bank of America brought that on itself by its silly arrangement with Merrill Lynch and by buying out Countrywide Financial. Now, oddly, Bank of America is bragging about that Countrywide Financial deal.
Oh, did you read that? That was funny.
The reason why they're able to do that is, well, the U.S. government's, again, guaranteeing some of that shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, without that U.S. government guarantee, that was a bad maneuver. So I don't like Bank of America. I don't like how it's acting. I don't like how Lewis is acting. I don't like how Pandit at Citigroup is acting. All of these guys are still so arrogant in the face of all of this, in the face of needing taxpayer bailouts and bailouts from the U.S. government. Well, the taxpayer, really. These guys just have not got it. And that's why the public is mad.
And they're, you know, mad. What? And it's not, I got to tell you something. Once again, these companies, you know, are doing something, some bad mechanical and accounting and issues. That's one thing. But you know what? These guys, Pandit is saying on one hand how everything is so solid and everything is so great. You know what? These guys have taken our country down. Seriously. I don't mean to be all like red, white, and blue patriotic here, but I'm serious. These guys took down our country. Why are they still in the driver's seat?
I don't know.
It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting.
It is. And what we're seeing here now, sadly, is that Obama promised change, yet Geithner is carrying on the same failed policies.
Yep.
Of Paulson.
Yep.
That's what's going on.
So with all this digging real deep and closing real deep, is there anything that could say that you could come up with that actually looks good aside from gold, anything that looks good, you know, kind of moving forward? Do we have even a shot at maybe some kind of a injection of some kind of funds into the economy a la $750 billion stimulus plan? I mean, does anything look like it's possibly going to give us a little boost here?
Actually, nothing does to me. And in fact, I think it's too late to short. I mean, if you're thinking about shorting now, it's way too late.
Right.
Now, of course, our strategies are market neutral at Sitka, and I think you're doing some of the same things.
Yep.
You're long some stuff, short some other stuff.
Right.
So if the market bounces, you're not going to get killed. But this is a very dangerous environment still to think about going long. And it's a dangerous environment to think about going short.
Yeah.
In fact, this is a great environment for just be
sitting on the sidelines,
watching and not caring.
Yeah.
And for the average person, that's what I would recommend. So far this year, we're navigating it pretty good at Sitka. Our two strategies are up. One of them's up about 1%. The other one's up about 1.5%, I think. So we're doing good. What's the S&P down so far this year? Do you know?
I think S&P's down about 18, I believe it was, last I saw.
Yeah, so to be up or down 1% or even around zero in the face of that pullback.
Well, it's just, you know what's tremendous about that?
Give yourself a pat on the back
if
that's what you're doing, and that's what I understand.
Yep,
so,
that's what we have. Yeah, and what's interesting about that is, also one of the big problems with investing is when the velocity, now, last 2 weeks I found to be very sloppy. There's been a trend down, obviously, but the trend was down, and we see some trends up every once in a while here. But the last couple of weeks were very sloppy. The uncertainty has reached epic proportions. And I found that, it's getting more and more difficult. And when I have difficulty seeing things clearly, not that I always see them clearly, I always step back and say, hey, what's going on here? Why is this like this? You know, what's happening that's behind the scenes and causing these problems? And I got to tell you, I think you're totally 100% right. I think that to try to catch the bottom right now will be disastrous. I mean, we are talking almost 20% down, and we're just finishing 2 months. Now, we're not going to speculate what the rest of the year is going to be right now, but I got to tell you something. That is simply ugly. That's not supposed to happen in a five-year stretch. Needless to say, 2 months, and then on top of the fact that we, you know, had a free fall. You and I had one of our podcasts back on October 23rd, and that was podcast number 80. And we predicted, you predicted, another 40% down at the time. At the time, it was kind of a questionable call. It was like, really, is it going to get there? Are we going to get into the 600s from that point where it was on the S&P 500? I mean, are we really going to get in the 6,000s? On the Dow, and I got to tell you something. It is, and I'm being straight with you, and I've been doing this a very, very long time. This is very scary times, and I have not been scared in 25 years of doing business. I've seen a lot of different things happen. This is scary because it's like watching your friend get beaten up, and there's nothing you can do about it.
I know. So many people had so many warnings to get out. And the sad thing is now people are asking me, well, you know, should I get out now? And the answer is, I don't know. It was easy in October. It was easy in October. It was easy last August. It was easy a year ago. Even in January, well, that was harder, but we still managed to do it.
Right.
Because, you know, I came out when the S&P hit, you know, 940, saying, okay, I, you know, just talked about it on my blog, saying, well, we're no longer net long. We had been playing for that Obama rally, but we no longer see it coming. And so even 940, in retrospect, looking back, was a good opportunity to get out. Is now one? I don't know.
Yeah.
Because looking ahead, I can see that technically maybe the S&P rallies at 600 or something, but that'll just be there's off of Fibonacci support.
Yeah, Fibonacci
there's no real technical support if you look at the chart until about 450. And if you look at the chart of the Dow, you see the same thing. It's around 7,000 now. But if you actually look at where the technical support is on the Dow, it's 4,500.
I'm going to give you a prediction. Right now, where we are exactly at this moment, okay, we are in at, and I say the word capitulation, not from a permanency, and I'll explain. We are at a capitulation point where there is going to be hands up in the air very shortly, people disgusted. They're going to look at their statements very shortly that they didn't want to look at for February, for example. And I got to tell you something. I am very fearful that we are going to, if we don't see any relief by, you know, very quickly, at least a stabilization, I think the average guy, everybody's just going to kind of put their hands up and say, you know what? Just like they did in October. Remember that deep cut in October?
Mm-hmm.
That intraday, like, what happened? We're going to see that again.
I think that's very likely. But it's hard to say. Even though it's likely, that doesn't mean it happens. We can discuss various scenarios. We can say we might get that panic right now. We can say that I think a better likelihood, actually, but hard to say, is that we just kind of drift down to a bottom of some kind with a panic low in September or October coming up, identical image to what happened in this last September and October, and then maybe that makes a bottom. But there's also a case that we just kind of drift lower for another 2 years to come, like Japan does, interrupted with brief rally somewhere along the line, none of which picks up any steam. That's very possible. And that is actually the worst alternative.
Yep.
The best thing would be if we just get this thing over with.
Yep.
But the tactics that Obama is using, that Geithner is using at the Fed, they're attempting to drag this thing out. They're attempting to keep these zombie banks alive. They're attempting to keep GM, a zombie corporation, alive. They're attempting to prop up the housing market. The very best thing that could happen is if the bottom fell out of the housing market. We got out of this thing. There was a panic low. Home prices fell to where people could afford to buy them. Then we can talk about a bottoming process.
Yeah.
As long as they delay that, Andrew.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's the thing to be scared about, and maybe that's what you're sensing here.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I don't see that they're going to let anything, you know, drop and die. They're so petrified, or at least they don't know what to do. I don't know if they're in over their heads. I can just tell you that leaving all these companies, I don't want anybody to be fired. I don't want any problems. But I'll tell you, just as you said, the longer this goes and the longer that they drag this thing out, the greater the pain is going to be for that much longer of a period. And to give, this is the thing that Buffett did back in October, and what's being done is giving false hope to people. And you know what? If Buffett didn't open his mouth in October and maybe said, you know, we want to buy America, but, you know, maybe you need to be careful right now. Can you imagine how much money would have been saved? But, I mean, that was in then. That was, you know, now. Now he's talking about the economy being in shambles for the for the foreseeable
exactly.
future, and he's taking the opposite side of the discussion here now. But, well, we'll pick this up again, my friend. I think that our conversations are always fascinating. I always get great emails. I encourage everyone listening to make sure to check out Mish's blog, of course. It's just type in Mish in Google, let's say, and you'll get right to him. We'll put a link on the site. And also, if you are disgusted with your portfolios, I'm going to give a big rah-rah for Mish in Sitka Pacific. He has a really a variety of different strategies that may make sense in this economy this market. And I think that everybody's waking up to the fact that buy and hold may not be the best answer for the foreseeable future, for the next 5-10 years at least. And maybe this is something that you need to look at, and I encourage you to check it out. So, my friend, thanks for coming by, and hopefully next time we talk, we could talk about a much happier subject.
Well, I sure hope so, but right now, getting in the last word, what seems to be happening is the frogs are slowly being boiled in order, and it's a process that should have been quick, but the Fed is delaying.
Yep. We'll use that as the name of our podcast, maybe. The frogs are being boiled. All right, thanks so much, my friend. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, we're going to end on that note. We have quite a bit of ground that we covered, and we're going to continue to beat this drum and make sure that you are safe. Of course, if you have any questions, actually, if you want to take a look at our private blog, that's the we have a client only blog. We love transparency. We love to talk about, you know, what we're doing good, what we haven't done so good, some of our successes. We don't like talking about it, but we do. We talk about our failures, how we're trading, why we're buying something, why we're selling something. All you have to do is write to trials@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You know, if you're thinking about becoming a client and maybe, you know, you're not sure what's going on, well, you know what? You can take a peek at the private client blog for about 10 days, and we'll do so by just sending us your information to trials@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Other than that, we're going to sign off for today. Been a long, long discussion, hopefully worthwhile. I hope to see you again next week. And, of course, check out DH Unplugged. It's now on iTunes as well. So long for now from the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.